You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702.
The upside of failure.
Sometimes failure is the foundation of greatest success stories.
I absolutely love our Friday conversations around failure, the stepping stones to success, the in-between moments of the successful moments. We're so preoccupied, so obsessed with shining a light on the glories and the achievements of people that we forget that it takes a really hard road to get there, a road that's often filled with disappointment, with things not going our way, with many areas sometimes failing around us. And so on Fridays, we explore the upside of failure, the moments of disappointment, but we look to the lessons from those experiences. And this afternoon, we join Ian Furr, an established businessman in South Africa. He founded the largest chain of beauty salons, the Sorbet Group, many years ago. And in 2017, he sold 100% of the business. And at the time, 211 stores or salons around the country were sold to Long for Life. That's how big this chain was. But he's had a fascinating career, interesting life. He was a music executive at some point, a beauty chain owner, a furniture retail store owner, just to name some of the things he's been involved in. But this afternoon, we not only catch up with him, but look at the upside of failures in his life. Good afternoon, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Azania. Thank you very much for having me.
So I was in the beauty industry and yours was always our competitor. Like, oh, there's a Sorbet in that center. Like, oh, how far is the Sorbet in that area? So you've managed to build an impressive business. Of course, you've gone on to sell it. But really, what an immense success.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Azania.
So you sold the business to Long for Life, and you went on to found a business coaching school, which you have aptly named Hatch Institute. And this is your efforts in teaching the next generation of leaders about what you call cultureneering. So what is that about? What does the Hatch Institute do?
Right. So the Hatch Institute really is a coaching and consulting business where we look at the importance of culture and service. And the name that I've come up with is cultureneering, which really means how to build a strong culture in a diverse workforce that will lay the platform for obsessive customer service. And it includes all kinds of elements of coaching. So it'll be personal development, leadership coaching, and of course, how to build a culture. And at the end of the day, to be able to create great service. Within that, we look at diversity and race relations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I was looking at some of the work that you're doing there. You say that there are four main elements that you look at: people, leadership, culture, and race relations. And that was the one that I was most curious about, because race relations, Ian, it's an interesting one that you included, because so many people would rather pretend that we not deal with the issue in the country, that we pretend it's not an issue. So why was it important for you, especially in the context of building businesses and a culture of improving service?
So for many years, Azania, I was involved in race relations right from the early days of my entrepreneurial journey. And I was exposed to people that I'd never been exposed to as a child. I grew up in a very privileged white environment. I went to a Jewish school. And then when we started our businesses, the first one was a retail business, I was exposed to black people for the very first time in my life. And our staff were all black, our customers were all black. So I had to learn how to communicate. I needed to learn to understand what was going on. And I found out fairly quickly that you needed to understand the socio-political environment in which people were living and working if you were able to then go out and then transform and teach and coach and lead. If you didn't understand the socio-political environment and the impact that apartheid was having at the time on people in their lives, race relations, then you would never be able to effectively run a business and get people to have a sense of belonging in the culture. And throughout all my years, I focused heavily on race relations, even to the sorbet business, where I started in 2004, and it was predominantly white beauty therapists that were involved. And I asked one of the companies, why is that so? Why are there no black people involved? I went to a launch, I said, we are the black people. And they said, well, they're not here. I said, was there a taxi strike or a transport problem or what happened here? And they said, no, all of our customers are white, and that they prefer to have white beauty therapists. And I thought to myself, no, that can't be right. And that night I actually decided that I would try and change the face of the beauty industry. And thankfully, that's what I managed to do. It's one of the most rewarding things I've done, really, is to look back as we literally changed the face of the beauty industry in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. So instead of forcing a culture on your workers, as you say, a sense of belonging, a common sense of belonging and collective purpose is what will deliver great customer service in the end.
And that's exactly right. If you don't have a sense of belonging and you don't have a common purpose, it's highly unlikely that you'll be able to deliver great service. I always say that the customer experience will never be better than the staff experience. And if your staff are not happy and they feel that they are not treated with respect, mm-hmm. and there's no sense of belonging, why in the world would they go out and try and serve your customers to the very best of their ability? That's not going to happen. So unless we strengthen the culture and we create an environment where people feel comfortable, accepted, respected, where their contributions are valued, then it's unlikely they'll ever really go out and serve to the best of their ability.
It's interesting because when you're running a franchise business, it must be difficult to get that sort of consistency of culture, of customer service to customers who are sitting in 211 stores.
And well, that was the biggest challenge. And right at the outset, I tried to understand why there were no beauty salon chains in South Africa. And soon enough, I realized it because it was all about consistency, because nobody had been able to really build a chain of salons across the country that was able to deliver consistent service right across. And the only way that we managed to achieve that was through culture and through the attitude of our people, because we got people to understand that they don't just come to work to make money. They come to work to serve the needs and wants of people. And if they do that well, they will make money at the end of the day.
Yes.
And so that was our philosophy. Yeah.
So you grew up in what, Vanderbijl Park?
Correct. I was born in Vanderbijl Park. And people asked, why was I born there? Which is a weird question, but I think it was because I wanted to be close to my mother. She was there at the time. So I was there until I was about 4 years old, and then we moved to Johannesburg. My father was one of the founding directors of Russell Furnishers in South Africa.
Yeah, so you come from an entrepreneurial family, but one of the failures that you shared with us is something that happened when you were 16. Take us through the challenge that you experienced that has shaped you, in fact, when you were 16.
Right, that was a seriously traumatic sort of part of my life. When I was 16, out of the blue, I developed a speech problem in the form of a severe stutter. And this had a massive impact on my self-confidence. From being confident and extroverted, I became severely anxious, fearful, and introverted. So much so that I didn't want to go to school anymore because I was so afraid that the teacher would ask me to stand up and read, and I didn't want to embarrass myself because I couldn't get the words out. My father had to go to the headmaster of the school and plead with him, please ask the teachers not to ask Ian to read in class, because if he carries on like this, he's going to leave school. He doesn't want to go to school anymore. Mm. I stopped speaking to people. I stopped answering the telephone. I wouldn't phone girls and ask them out anymore. And I decided, after the army and successfully dropping out of university, I decided that if I wanted to be in business and to be an entrepreneur, which was my dream, I needed to be able to communicate. So I decided one day that I was going to face my biggest fear and to do the thing that frightened me most, was to go and learn to do public speaking. So I went to Dale Carnegie for a course, and I had to do a talk for 2 minutes once a week for 14 weeks in a row. And that was perhaps the most traumatic period of my entire life. And it was so, I was so anxious. I was shaking most of the time. It was just really horrible. But bit by bit, I started to overcome this. And eventually, after that course, I went to other courses until eventually I was able to speak a bit more comfortably. Mm-hmm. And now I make a living out of public speaking. And if you had told me that when I was 16 mm-hmm. years old, that I would make a living of public speaking, I would have thought that you were completely smoking your socks. So it was just, yeah, it's been a big lesson to, you know, to me, is that you must never stop trying to do what you want to do. I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I had to face my fears, and I had to find the courage to do that. And courage is not really the absence of fear. Courage is the ability to overcome the fear. And that was really the big lesson there for me in my early years.
Do you still get scared even today?
I do often. I get scared, but I just fight it all the time. It's an ongoing battle for me. My whole life has been like that. It's been a battle. But I'm not prepared to allow it to beat me, so I just keep at it.
Yes. It's going to remain a permanent 1-0 to you. It's going to remain that way. That's the score, and that's it for a lifetime. I've never met a single person who does public speaking who has ever said that they don't get scared. And so I always think we love the edge. You know, there's something about being on that edge, not past your terror, but just beyond your comfort zone, but not past your terror, where you get to confront the things that could easily hold you down if you let them.
Yes, indeed. And so that was the thing for me. That was my lesson. And I've tried to help other people with that as well when they have fears that they need to overcome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, just face it. And then tell us the story about your second failure, the story of Kmart.
That's right. So we opened Kmart in 1976. I was a young boy of 22, young man, I suppose, of 22. My older brother came back from America, and he said that he had seen this business called Kmart, and we should open a Kmart in South Africa and aim it at the black market. It was a departmental discount store. And I asked him who was going to run this business, and he pointed at me, and I had no idea about anything about retailing. I had no idea about the black market. But anyway, I was young and naive, and I said, okay, let's do this. So we started in 1976. We opened our first store. And over a period of time, I had to learn, as I mentioned earlier on, to communicate with people that were different to me and came from a different background. I had a mentor who took me into Soweto and taught me all of the things. And it was interesting because we opened right in July 1976, which was about 2 weeks after the start of the uprisings in Soweto. So it was a very traumatic time and very volatile. But we opened and we carried on. And about 9 years later, 1985, I think it was, we had the Rubicon speech from P.W. Botha, which really set the country back significantly. And there was a lot of mass action and the UDM and all these people now, all the groups were starting to boycott white-owned stores. And we were one of those stores. Mm-hmm. Even though we were one of the first businesses, as far as I'm aware, that had black directors and shareholders. We were still majority white-owned, and at the end of 1985, it hit us really hard. We did about 15% of our budgeted turnover, and eventually we were put into liquidation. My brother and I were both sequestrated, but my father helped us to buy the business back out of liquidation. We renamed it Supermart, and some people might remember Supermart, and ultimately sold it to Edcon in 2002, who then rebranded it as Jetmart. Mm. And today it's still called Jetmart. And so that was another one of the stories where we had learned many lessons. And when we reopened the business, we applied all of the lessons we had learned prior to the liquidation. Even though the liquidation was a little bit out of our control, there were still many mistakes that we were making, and we learned those. And we rebuilt the business and then sold it ultimately after 27 years of being in that business. Sure. Even though I came and went, because I was also involved in a race relations consultancy in between that, and a music business. So all kinds of things were going on, but at the end of the day, we were able to sell that business, and it was highly successful at the time.
What do you believe your mistakes were, and what were the lessons out of that?
Well, I think that mainly it was financial. We didn't really understand the importance of getting your accounts out properly and on time. We didn't really sort of manage people properly the way that we should have. The culture at first wasn't right. And then I started to learn about culture. And after the liquidation, I started to apply the culture blueprint that I've developed over the years. And that was one of the big lessons, is that if you can build a strong culture, you'll be able to build a culture of service. And if you can build a culture of service, then you've got a much better chance of success.
Is that the time when you had one of Azapo's senior members, Laibon Mabasa, working for you?
That's correct. He was our dispatch manager. Believe it or not, he was doing our work during the day as a dispatch manager. And at night, he was plotting the overthrow of the government. So that was his moonlighting job.
Mm-hmm.
But we learned a hell of a lot from him and other people like Letsatsi Mosala, who was one of the leaders of the Black Consciousness Movement at the time. They were working with us, and that's where I learned so much about race relations. I started to learn about Black consciousness. I read everything I could possibly get my hands on from Steve Biko. And so I started to understand the real impact of racism and systemic racism on South Africa. Unfortunately, not enough people, particularly white people in South Africa, really understand the extent of the social injustice that has preceded this country in terms of the old colonial days and apartheid as well. People don't really understand the extent of it. The laws, some of the laws that were so inhumane, but still, you know, there are people who say, well, I don't believe that I was privileged or anything like that. And so we try and get, you know, as part of the Hedge situation, we try and get people to understand the true impact of racism and institutionalized and systemic racism on the country, and the fact that the racial polarization that we see today is one of the biggest challenges we face in South Africa. Virtually everything we do in this country is touched by race, and it's our job to try and do something about it. Each and every one of us, in my view, has a moral obligation to try and uplift this country, to try and create equality for all, and to try and create opportunities so that we can have a real South Africa where everybody feels comfortable, fits in, and can succeed.
Mm. And then let's fast forward to something in more recent times. About 6 years ago, you had a successful chain of salons in this country, and then you decided to go overseas. And this was, you set your sights on the UK, and you decided to open a number of stores there, but then went into liquidation. What do you believe was the failure with that business move?
I think it was largely my own arrogance. I was just a bit arrogant. I thought, you know, based on the success we were having in South Africa, that it would be easy to just transform what we had done here and plonk it down in the UK, and people would come charging in. And that really was far from the truth. And we learned very quickly that wasn't going to happen, that we didn't fully understand the market. The market's very different, even though it looked the same from the outside. Mm-hmm. And it looked like there was a massive opportunity to open a chain of beauty salons in the UK, because there wasn't, and there still isn't, one single chain of beauty salons in the whole of the UK, not one of any significance. And so it just seemed like a low-hanging fruit, and it would be like taking candy from a baby. it wasn't quite that easy, and we made some really costly mistakes. And we just kind of transposed what we had done here. We put it there, and we thought, well, people are going to love this because the look and feel of the stores in the UK seemed pretty archaic to us. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, our new look and our bright look and everything that we had was going to dazzle the people there, but not quite. So, but we had to close all six of those stores. That was a very costly learning experience.
Mm.
But it doesn't put me off, you know. I still believe that if you want to be an entrepreneur, you cannot be afraid to fail. And so failure is a part of success. And you can't look back at your past success and expect that everything's going to go right. The one lesson I've really learned is that looking back at past successes, you know, gives you nothing but a stiff neck. And that's really the worst thing you can do is just believe that you have the Midas touch and life has a horrible way of bringing you back down to earth. So that was a big lesson.
Oh, you've said such a mouthful. I love the points you're making now about believing in that past success and thinking it'll always be with you and never being afraid, not to be afraid to fail. Listen, so you failed at trying to open 6 stores in London. We opened a store in Pretoria, also thinking that we've got the success in Johannesburg. Ah, Pretoria is just 40 minutes away from Johannesburg. Not much of a difference. Come on, should be the same. It does. Was also a miscalculation. So,
welcome to the club.
Exactly. It might not have been as far or as expensive, but it was still quite costly.
Indeed, it is, yeah.
So, comforted to hear you say that. But having built these massive businesses before, what is it like now starting a new venture from scratch after years of running established businesses, of having started businesses? Here you are now starting another business from scratch.
Right. So, look, as far as running businesses is concerned, I'm not really very good at running large, huge corporates, which is what Sorbet became. And at the time that I left, the combined turnover of all the franchises was over R1 billion. And that wasn't exactly what I was good at, to be honest. That wasn't my strength. And I prefer to start new businesses. I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. I love the idea of starting new businesses. I started Sorbet when I was 51 years old, and I've now started Hatch at 66 years old. And so I will just keep on starting businesses and trying to build them, and then just keep trying to do that as long as I can.
Yeah.
And, you know, until I fall over eventually, I suppose.
So you start them, you know, hand them over, and start again. That's where the thrill lies for you.
Right.
Absolutely.
Exactly
wonderful.
That.
Thank you so much. I think there's so much to listen back to, in fact, just to take in again, absorb a second time, especially for people who want to go into business, who have that entrepreneurial streak and love the space. There's you've really given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you so much, Azania.
Well, Gary,
and thanks to everybody.
Gary Johnson has sent us a message saying, I had the pleasure of working with Ian in the music industry. Very hard working. His motto was, there's 24 hours in the day and then there's the night. So that comes from Gary Johnson, Ian, just as a parting shot. Do you still believe the same thing?
Absolutely. 24 hours in the day and then there's the night. Exactly.
Oh,
that's what I believe.
That's what it takes, I guess. That's what it takes. Thank you very much, Ian.
Right. Thank you very much, Azania. I appreciate it.
That is Ian Furr, and entrepreneur, and he gave us the Sorbet chain of salons, and now the coaching and consulting institute, Hatch Institute, where he teaches the next generation of leaders how to really set up the culture of your organization if you want to succeed and deliver great customer service.